Welcome to Pentagon Solutions on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. Here's your host, Tom Temin.
Even as the Iraq and Afghanistan wars recede into history, problems with traumatic brain injury endure. A study by researchers at Johns Hopkins University finds that those injured before 2007 are most at risk for chronic problems. That's before the Defense Department medical officials started more regular and detailed TBI screenings. Joining me with more, study co-author Rachel Chase from Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. Dr. Chase, great to have you on.
I'm really happy to get to talk about combat veterans and invisible injuries. Thank you.
Tell us about the scope and really the goals of the research that you did.
So we began this research to help answer a question that was asked by combat veterans who were deployed to Iraq and Afghanistan. And that was specifically, by how much were deployment-related traumatic brain injuries undiagnosed? And to do that, we first turned to military surveillance data to answer that question. After 2007, that surveillance data showed great increases in traumatic brain injury, primarily because they started to screen for it. Using that data, we create a model that provide a very conservative estimate of undiagnosed traumatic brain injuries. But that conservative estimate was that 80%, and it's 80%, of traumatic brain injuries incurred by deployed service members went undiagnosed early in those wars.
Do we know how many individuals that might have been in total?
Tens of thousands, according to our estimates.
By going undiagnosed, then what is the effect on that person's life after they muster out of the military?
Well, our since there are still plenty of those traumatic brain injuries that have never been diagnosed, it was a little hard to get at exactly that answer. So our best attempt was to interview veterans and families of veterans who had been exposed to the most common cause of combat-related traumatic brain injury, which were blasts. So we talked to people who had been deployed before 2007 and sometimes after 2007 as well in a later deployment who had been exposed to multiple blasts. And we asked them what had happened in the decade about since they had been deployed.
I guess one of the problems with these blast-related brain injuries is the same phenomenon that happens in football. They get a blast, an injury, a roadside bomb, or whatever the case might be, and then because there's no external injury, you can't see what's wrong, they try to get back into combat because they don't want to let down the rest of the squad.
Absolutely. And, as you're pointing out, in both scenarios, both in football and in the military, you have these cases where they're very highly motivated to stick with their team and continue to do the job that they're there to do. And, even when they have visible injuries, if they can get back out in the field, they try to. So, of course, if you have an invisible injury and if, traumatic brain injuries aren't really on the military's radar as they were not before 2007, it's quite easy to put yourself at increased risk because we do know that one of the best things that you can do for yourself after a traumatic brain injury is get rest. And that's one thing that these guys were not getting when they were deployed to Iraq and Afghanistan, exposed to blast.
In these interviews, what did you discover about what the long-term effects are?
Well, we didn't try to just focus on, what happened if you had a TBI, because we weren't trying to diagnose TBI. Rather, what we did was look at the holistic experience of service members who had been exposed to blast and very likely incurred a traumatic brain injury. And so, what we saw were that in this decade of experiences that they described, first they told us about, the context of the injury and, it was chaotic after a blast. And no one wanted to be the guy who was complaining about headaches and nausea and disorientation, loss of hearing, changes in sight, or things like that when everyone else was experiencing the same things. And some people had, quote, real injuries like blood and broken bones after a blast. If these veterans did seek help for the issues while they were in the field early on, before TBI was a known issue, not much help was really offered. And then once they returned from deployment, they continued to deal with issues that they faced privately, in part because they thought they were the only ones who were dealing with depression, anxiety, social withdrawal, and volatility. And that was, if they even recognized their own symptoms. A lot of veterans weren't aware of their own memory loss and mood volatility until someone else pointed them out. They often denied their need to seek care because they thought it was completely up to them to deal with their problems on their own. And it usually wasn't until some kind of wake-up call, like a spouse threatening to leave them or losing a job or having some near-death experiences, that they would seek help.
These stories and what you heard, what does that tell us about the treatment that should take place after a blast, or has the DOD addressed that problem since 2007?
Department of Defense has done a lot to address the problem in the field. Not to say that, you know, the screening system is perfect, but, you know, when I talk to veterans who had been deployed after 2010, you know, especially if they, you know, worked in, you know, bomb squads, awareness about traumatic brain injury was quite high, and there are, you know, polytrauma centers now, both as part of the military health system and the veteran health system, that are intended to deal with the, you know, multiple problems that veterans face due to injuries that cause, you know, kind of full system problems or multiple injuries. But, you know, that said, if you have a veteran who, you know, was deployed maybe from 2004 to 2005 and then left the military before any of this screening, and they go to the VA now, they have, you know, major problems that, you know, they're talking about in terms of documentation. They need to prove to the VA that, you know, they have health problems that are related to their service. And, you know, blast exposure and traumatic brain injuries weren't documented back then. In fact, blast exposure still is not being documented in the military. So to provide that documentation is quite difficult. And so, you know, what veterans often spoke about was having to, you know, fight for their care, and their families echoed this sentiment that families of both current service members and veterans felt as though, you know, their veterans wouldn't have gotten the care they did without, you know, kind of the entire family getting involved to advocate for them.
Rachel Chase is a researcher with Johns Hopkins University's Department of Public Health. And let me ask you this. When it comes to treatment of traumatic brain injury, is the phenomenon true here that the sooner you get treatment, the more effective it is, almost like a heart attack or a stroke where that first golden hour is so important? Or is it less of a factor in TBI?
It's, in fact, very important to get early care when possible. That said, you know, if a veteran is thinking, wow, I you know, got incurred this blast, this injury, you know, 10 years ago, if they're experiencing problems, they should still be seeking care. You know, we can only improve care if we know what these patients are facing, and you know, it will get better as, you know, more people are consistently coming to physicians with the same problems, and we begin to recognize patterns, and we can provide better care, understanding their needs.
Are there physiological markers for TBI? Can you do a brain scan of some kind, of an MRI, and see it?
We're still working on that, and there we have definitely improved, especially, you know, diffuse tensor imaging, for example, is a type of MRI that is now available that can see a lot of the injuries that, you know, occur with blast injury. But there are a lot of different technologies that we're trying to develop currently. Most of the advances that we're seeing, where we can kind of definitively tell a difference in brains of blast-exposed veterans versus others when we're able to actually cut their brains up. So unfortunately, for those who want to keep their brains in their head, it's a little more difficult. But we're definitely working on biomarkers. And again, the more people who are seeking care for it, the more that we can understand what's going on. If it's an invisible population to us, it's very difficult to do the studies necessary to improve identification and care.
Now, you were a math and English teacher in China, and we're hoping to go back to do that. So you came into this field of TBI research in kind of an unusual way. Tell us about that.
So my brother was was an Iraq veteran with the Army, and through connections with him, some veterans found out that I was getting my PhD in international health, and they thought to come to me and ask, you know, if I would be interested in doing this study. And initially, I, you know, just thought, like, I really want to go back to China. But, you know, the more that I looked into it, I realized it was very hard to find, you know, research that was describing the experiences that they were talking about. And I thought, you know, the research community needs to know about this. So, you know, I did a bit of a turnaround to start this research.
And so what happens with this research now? Has it been presented to, say, VA or to DOD, or what will be the practical effect of it?
Well, you know, our first step is to publish in, you know, peer-reviewed literature. And so, you know, we've got two papers out from this project now. A third one will come out in Military Medicine in February. And you know, getting this public discourse is really one of the most important ways of getting the attention of, you know, other researchers, of, you know, politicians who are engaging in the reform of, you know, the VA, the military health system, and of other stakeholders in this process. So, you know, getting the conversation going about, you know, invisible effects of, you know, combat, you know, and combat injuries is, you know, kind of an important step, really, in this entire process.
And how is your brother doing?
My brother's doing great. He's on his way to be an anesthesiologist at this point, so he's doing pretty well.
Medical Family. Rachel Chase is researcher with Johns Hopkins University's Department of Public Health. Thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you.
Share this interview with colleagues. Go to federalnewsradio.com/Federal Drive and click share with friends. I'm Tom Temin.
Pentagon Solutions will return after these messages. You're listening to Pentagon Solutions on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. Now here's your host, Tom Temin.
If you can say anything good about battlefield wounds, it's this. They often have produced advances in emergency medical treatment that can benefit not only troops, but anyone who suffers a similar injury. But only if the treatment experience is captured and taught. 14 years of hard-won learning from the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan are in danger of evaporating. That's according to former Surgeon General Richard Carmona. In this interview with Federal News Radio's Eric White, Carmona explains why he thinks this is such an important issue.
Well, I've been involved with the military for most of my life, having been an Army Special Forces soldier. I'm a disabled veteran, and also being a physician and then Surgeon General of the United States. So I have been continually involved with the military and civilian populations as it relates to the best care available.
What sorts of medical advances are at risk of being lost if they're not ordered as mandatory from our most recent conflicts?
Well, first and foremost, the military has a lot to be proud of because after every conflict we have, our emergency medical systems get better, care improves. But what we learned in the past was as the wars wind down and young men and women go back to civilian life, the lessons of war are lost as it relates to the best types of resuscitation, what we call buddy care today, that the care starts with the infantryman that's standing next to you when you're injured. And we saw after Vietnam and between that and Gulf One, we lost the capacity in the military. There weren't many people around that remembered that stuff. So one of the things we're trying to emphasize that it's important to have a process in place that we continue to refresh the memories of these experiences so that at all times as we move forward, we are always prepared for these worst-case scenarios, i.e. going back to battle.
Why is it that these practices get lost so easily? Is it just because they're not taught readily afterwards or nobody even cares to write them down or even keep track of them?
I think there's a number of issues. After the Vietnam War, there were a number of surgeons, Dr. Bellamy, Dr. Rich, who had registries of types of injuries, and that was the first time it was really done. But it took over a decade before that information started to permeate into the military and into the civilian EMS systems so we could provide better care for not only civilian patients who are injured, but those in battle. And we see the same thing happening then as we got to Gulf One. There weren't enough trauma surgeons. Our medics weren't up to speed on combat casualty care, largely because the persons that had had the experience from Vietnam had retired, and those lessons were lost. So part of the importance of the paper is to reemphasize the importance of the continuity, that we have training that is ongoing, even during peacetime, so we never lose the capacity of providing the best care for our soldiers, our sailors, our airmen, and so on.
At the beginning of each operation, it seems that we're always playing catch-up to whatever techniques there are in critical care. Are there soldiers' lives that are potentially lost because starting out in a new operation, they're not up to speed on what the newest techniques are?
Well, there's no question that there were preventable deaths in our most recent war right now. There were a number of studies done, and simple things like using pressure on a wound, on an extremity wound, traumatic amputations, which we saw a lot of with the IEDs, using a tourniquet, which for many years people thought was not the thing to do, but all of the evidence now tells us that tourniquets are life-saving. And in the studies that have been done, it's been clear that we have saved lives that have otherwise would have died. And in studies that were done looking at preventable deaths, there are many soldiers and sailors and airmen who died because they did not receive the appropriate care in a timely fashion on the battlefield, that people didn't know how to use the tourniquet. People didn't know how to put a compression dressing on, what they call a hemostatic dressing. All of those things are being reported now, and Dr. Smith, Dr. Butler, and myself want to ensure that this type of information is memorialized, institutionalized, and that it continues to be passed down from soldier to soldier, sailor to sailor, so that we never lose that capacity.
Who should be in charge? The structure of the military, it doesn't even have doctors really handling that. Do you think that there should be some sort of new agency or a new wing of DOD to make sure that these practices are institutionalized?
I'm not sure we need another bureaucracy to deal with it. I think what we do need to do is to shine a light on this and ensure that all the combatant commanders who ultimately have the responsibility for the readiness of their units, that they are aware and that all the way up to the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the Secretary of Defense, they recognize how important these skills are and that it becomes part of the training doctrine so that it is always there and always taught and actually part of evaluations as to unit readiness. That all of these capabilities are checked, just like we check physical ability and ability to fire a firearm. We also want to check that they have the medical capability. And that's not only medics, that includes the frontline combatant, the infantrymen, the riflemen and the Marines, that they have buddy care down, that they're carrying their emergency kit. Every one of them has a little first aid kit that has a bandage, that has a tourniquet. Those are life-saving devices, and sometimes the difference between life and death is just minutes so that a combatant can take care of his fellow through buddy care, what we call buddy care, pending the arrival of a medic and a medevac helicopter. These are life-saving skills that are very simple to implement, but we must institutionalize it and make sure that this information continues to be reinforced as part of the military doctrine directed by the Secretary of Defense and the Joint Chiefs of Staff.
Is part of this problem also that DOD is not always prepared for what kind of threats soldiers are going to actually be facing on the ground?
I think every war is different.
Yes.
You know, there's a lot of similarities. For instance, in Vietnam, we had IEDs, but back then they were called booby traps. They were not as, you know, the incidence wasn't as high. We didn't see as many, but nevertheless, they were there. Back then, we fought what was called guerrilla warfare and were involved in insurgency and counterinsurgency. You know, today we call it terrorism. I mean, there's a lot of similarities. Some of the weapons change, some of the techniques change, but the combat casualty care doesn't change that much. From when I was a Special Forces medic in Vietnam, the same skills are applied today. We just have to make sure that we use those skills appropriately and continue to teach them so that we never fall into this sense of complacency between conflicts, and then we have to catch up.
What about branches working together using their specialties? For instance, I know after the Gulf War, the Air Force's Medical Services Critical Care Transport Team made a lot of adjustments as far as, you know, being able to actually transport severely wounded soldiers. Do you think that branches need to do a better job working together to ensure that the safety of their soldiers and health of their soldiers is a top priority?
I think that the branches are working phenomenally well. When I was vice president of the Defense Health Board, I went downrange, was at Landstuhl, our trauma center. You know, I went on the CCATs. I talked to the medics in the field. And there was no doubt in my mind that we were working as a purple uniform, a single service. Army, Navy, Air Force, all of our officers there and our enlisted men were working cooperatively. There was no difference. And we used the term purple uniform to really describe the fact that we worked as one. So when you look at the field hospitals, you know, the medic in the field, the medevacs, the buddy care, the combat casualty care that's received, the forward surgical hospital, the evacuation to the trauma center in Landstuhl, and you go to the offices that actually oversee and administer this, you see Navy people, Army, Air Force, and they work seamlessly because we recognize the focus is all of our young men and women who are in harm's way, independent of what uniform they wear. What we'd like to do with the article, of course, is to recognize the unbelievably positive contributions that the military makes to emergency care that begins with combat casualty care. But we also want to make sure that there's no complacency and that there are programs in place as we wind down our wars, that the training continues, that our civilian, that our military medics, nurses, and surgeons and doctors rotate to civilian trauma centers so that they can keep their skills up. There are programs like that in place, but of course they're always threatened because of budgets. So it's extremely important that these critical skills are not allowed to perish and that we keep them first and foremost available because we never know when we're going to need them.
Dr. Richard Carmona is a veteran and former Surgeon General of the United States, speaking with Federal News Radio's Eric White. Share this interview with colleagues. Go to federalnewsradio.com/Federal Drive and click Share with Friends. I'm Tom Temin.
You've been listening to Pentagon Solutions. Download this show or any of our weekly programs anytime at federalnewsradio.com. Search Pentagon Solutions.